So now we're going to move on to our next part of the program. The title of it is very intriguing. It's Peril and Potential: How Technological Advances Are Affecting Students and Their Literacy. Our presenter is NABT's own Susan Schulter, who is an English instructor at West Valley Community College in Saratoga, California. So without any further ado, let me bring on Susan Schulter.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me here this afternoon. I would like to just get a little voice sense of who's here. How many in this room are teachers and or retired teachers? Just a yes?
Yes.
Okay. How many here are students?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Very good. And how many are here just out of interest? Just, what's going on?
Very good. I'm really thrilled because we are all lifelong learners, and if there's one thing that we know when we think about literacy, that is the access to communication and information and that which connects us, it is the fact that we are all learners in this way. I want to stress the word in my title, and, that little conjunction that connects, not peril or potential, but peril and potential. After all, we've just seen how wonderfully technology has brought Bookshare into our lives, and we just received a wonderful story from Alabama about students accessing Hamlet and experiencing that literacy together. And so in no way am I here today to kvetch and complain about technology. What we do know is that literacy is changing, and experts call it generational literacy. You know, there was a period where generations typically read a lot of newspapers, and when education tended to stop at the high school and two-year level, there was a different kind of literacy, and then we had a television generation of literacy, and now we have computer literacy, and different things happen in that. I envision this day together as a conversation, a workshop, a round table, a seminar. I'm not an expert in this field. I'm a facilitator, a person who raises questions. I did some preliminary research to bring some ideas to you here, but I'm trying to pitch what we're doing to all of us, to people who are teaching K through 12, to people who are teaching community college or university, to people who are tutoring as well, teaching in private institutions or public institutions, schools for the blind, whether we teach sighted or blind or people with other disabilities. I want to suggest that what is going on technologically is changing what we're receiving from our students, how they think, how they process, and so on. And so I'm going to offer some general principles, and then I'm going to invite your input. And one of our final activities for the day will be to construct what we call technology literacy autobiographies. First, I want to throw out a few terms that I'm sure are really familiar. Screen readers, texting, hey, text me, speech synthesizers, World Wide Web, email, Twitter, Facebook, instant messaging, Blackboard, WebCT, talking calculator, touchscreen, interface, PowerPoint, paperless braille, links, and my favorite, point and click. Click before I even know what I'm doing. Remember the saying, ready, aim, fire? Clicking is starting to create people who ready, fire, aim. In other words, not following the process all the way through, and we'll get to that. So my questions that I'm going to bring to the table for us today are these, and you don't have to memorize all these, but I'll just go slowly. How are these technologies affecting our students' language literacy, mathematical literacy, scientific literacy, and artistic musical literacy? How is Braille literacy being affected? What changes are we as teachers noticing in how our students learn? Are the new technologies increasing our students' access to knowledge? Are they increasing the speed at which our students learn? How about the depth of what they learn? Are they changing the ways in which our students process information? Are technologies changing how our students' ability to, are technologies changing our students' ability to demonstrate what they know? What changes, and here's the key for us, I think, what changes are we as teachers observing in how our students read, write, compute, communicate, and learn? How are these changes affecting the ways in which we teach? These are the points that I hope that we can touch upon in the next half hour or so. I do not have the answers, but I have learned a long time ago that what you need are questions, because that gets you where you need to go. But I can share some trends. And so we're going to have a discussion where we share our own classroom experiences, positive and challenging, that have come about as a result of these technologies. When and wherever possible, I'd like each of us to weigh in on these questions. And then there's the literacy autobiography that I would like to work with you a little bit later if we have some time. And even if you don't have a writing implement, do not worry, because you can still participate. But before I do that, I'd like to share, let me move on a little bit here. Sorry, does your Braille display ever do a mutiny on you? Okay. I'd like to share really quickly a little bit of the background sleuthing that I did to prepare for today's workshop. It's a seven-title bibliography. I have both a short version and a longer annotated version, and I am happy to make it available to anyone who wants it via email if you just let me know afterwards. I decided to save our press room a little work, but I will go through that. I acknowledge my language arts bias. My criteria for including the sources that I found are these, and not necessarily in these order. A, sources that address the range of the students we teach, knowing that we go from K through college, and lifelong learners. B, sources on literacy and technology that are accessible to all of us via WebRail, NLS, or Bookshare. I did not give you sources that you couldn't use, because that makes me crazy. C, reliability, thoroughness, creativity of sources. D, sources that address blind and visually impaired learners, in particular, as well as non-disabled, light-sighted learners. And as I said, those criteria aren't necessarily in order of importance. So at this point, why don't I just share very briefly the titles. Is this a good pace for people? Okay. I don't want to cut into our talking time too soon. And by the way, if someone could let me know, when I want to make sure there's a good, 15 minutes for lots of interaction. So can someone keep time? That would be wonderful. The first source that I found is called Essential Literacy Experiences with Visually Impaired Children by Eva Levine, Education Specialist, TSBVI, Visually Impaired Outreach, Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness, 91, 14, those are the pages. How many of you here teach K through 6 or 8? Thereabouts? Okay. This one's for you. I found this on the World Wide Web. It's the full text of the article. The essence of what Ms. Levine writes is this. Sighted children, before their parents read to them or before they encounter basal readers or whatnot, sighted children see much of what they read about. You read a story where Auntie Jill is making a bed. That sighted child has observed that process many times. Do you follow? Okay, we're giving a party for Tilly and someone blew up balloons and one popped. Well, that might be more accessible. The point is there are a number of activities that sighted children witness all the time that blind children witness, but maybe at a different avenue and maybe at a different pace. Would you agree? And unless you've actually experienced those things as a child, when you read about them, the reading is not going to be as lively for you. Anybody who's ever petted an elephant knows that the word elephant is very different once you've touched the bristly hide. And so the point that she makes in her article is that we need to provide reading for visually impaired children with as many kinesthetic and haptic support systems as we possibly can, so that when they're reading, they're actually touching the wagon wheel in the mind as they touch the braille or encounter the large print. She recommends that students learn whichever medium or access whichever medium is better for them, but the point she says is that if, just because they're reading the book, they're reading, for them to be literate, they have to have internalized that experience in the body, which I think is a key difference between literacy and reading. Would you agree?
Yes.
It's when it gets inside you and you go, hot dog, it's mine. That's what it's about. The second site that I found on the World Wide Web, just through good old-fashioned Google, is called Open Doors to Learning, Reading, Writing, and Technology-Rich Learning Across the K-12 Curriculum. And it is a web-based workshop with links to curriculum activities such as using field guides. You know, field guides are books where you learn about flowers or butterflies or cities or whatever. You have students read them, but then you have them go create their own field guide. You know, the field guide to my school, for instance. Writing with writers, read, write math, I liked that one. Reading strategies that work and strategies that don't, that link is for teachers. Learning to integrate standards-based technology-enhanced reading and writing experiences into your curriculum. These are just links I found on the site. I mean, I read them all the way through, but God bless you. Incorporate authentic online primary source materials, connect with reading, web-based resources, etc. It goes on and on and on. You just click on any of these, and there's all these neat articles and class activities, and here's the part I liked, student examples, student blogs, etc. Oh, we forgot blog in our list. So I recommend that site to you, and I'm very happy to communicate that URL. Is this too slow? Is this too much info? Okay. The third source is called The Importance of Braille Literacy. It's by Sarah J. Blake, and it is an entire online article. And if there's time at the end of the presentation, I would actually like to read a couple paragraphs of that article to you, because she says some things about the need for Braille for our visually impaired children and what Braille literacy means about life that really brought tears to my eyes. And I don't cry that easy. I used to cry when I saw Bambi. I'm a little better. But anyway, you know, it's really good. So if we have time, remind me of that. I'll just gloss the last of these. The fifth source is from the National Council of Teachers of English, NCTE, website, and it's called Read, Write, Think, Lesson Plan, Paying Attention to Technology, and it's where I got the toy called the Literacy Autobiography. Number six I found at Bookshare, and it's called Multiliteracies for a Digital Age by Stuart A. Selber, Southern Illinois University Press, copyright 2004, so we know we're nice and current, by the Conference on College Composition and Communication, National Council of Teachers of English. And I have an ISBN number and everything for you for that, so if you want one. And then the last source, also from Bookshare, is called Computers in the Composition Classroom, a Critical Source Book, edited by Michelle Seidler, Auburn University, Arizona, Bedford St. Martin's, copyright 2008. Now, more on these later, but some of the ideas that I'm going to talk about now, about trends that we're seeing in student literacies, came from these last two sources. So I want to say that what I'm going to talk about for the next 6 minutes or 7 minutes or so came from these last two articles, and I'm shooting myself in the head right now because it occurs to me that I'm not letting you talk. Okay, just a little more. So this section is called From the Classroom. Here's what the two sources on the two final sources that I found on Bookshare have to say about the following phenomenon. And as I share this with you, I'll share what goes on with you in my classroom. Quickly, the community college at which I teach has a student body of 12,000 students. Our demographics are 55% Caucasian. We have a very large Latino population, a substantial Persian population, a substantial Vietnamese population, and other smaller minorities. Most of our disabled students have learning disabilities. Every 2 years or so, I find myself with someone visually impaired. So I want you to be aware of the demographics from which I deliver so that what I say here makes sense. And the first phenomenon that I want to talk about and get some feedback from you is texting and email. Okay, what does that mean in terms of what happens to our students as writers? Well, here's what the researchers say, and here's what I can tell you about that, and then I want you to tell me. One thing that it means is writing proliferation. People are writing much more than they used to in many senses, because they're always writing notes to somebody. Hey, what you doing? Meet you at 3 o'clock at Starbucks, yada, 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 right? Got a book. Would you agree? You know? So the language is happening. And, you know, we know that fluency, to some extent, makes us better. It's a confidence builder. What with the blogging that's going on, we're getting more confident about self-publishing, I guess, hopefully in a good way. But what's also happening is that we're getting proliferation minus revision, minus proofreading, and minus completion. Okay? Very recently, in an honors English 1C critical thinking class, I received an essay from a student, and it contained a number of slang terms. You know, the president shouldn't do this crap. He had statements like that. Now, I want to hasten to say that I don't want to pick on students as victims or learn. I hope I don't sound that way. I'm trying to give you examples of what. And then he had some interesting text spellings in there. He had T-R-U for through. He had L-U-V for love. He had a number of things. And when we talked, he said, oh. And I said, well, you know, he says, is this language wrong? I said, no, it's not wrong, but you're writing an academic paper. And so it's kind of like you've showed up to your interview for AT&T wearing your gardening blue jeans instead of your suit. You know, it's different language. And so what I am finding is that writing often remains at the first draft level in papers, especially because when students word process, things look clean in a way that they don't when they're handwritten. When you type a page, it can have grammatical errors, it can have spelling errors, it can have homonym errors, it can have all kinds of things, but it looks pretty, right? Especially if you've got gorgeous fonts. How many of you teach students who do C?
Yes.
Okay, and who work with print? So this makes sense, yes? Okay, and so these are the issues that we have to work with, and it means that in our classrooms, one of the discussions that we need to have really early on is the presentation. And being careful not to be confused by the glitz, by the image. Remember that your spell checker won't catch the homonyms. Remember that the grammatical checker isn't always right. And pay a lot of attention to those things. And we as writers ourselves will have to pay attention to that. I get to talk about my favorite now, point and click. Well, it said do, so I hit do, and I just lost my file. Well, yeah, okay. The point-and-click syndrome has been available to us ever since we've had Windows technologies. And it's for people who can see and who read parallelly, which means the kind of the broad-based literacy, it's neat because you look at something you want and you click and something happens. But the other side of that point-and-click is that we sometimes behave the way people do with the television remote control, where they just lie there and go click, 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 and spend 2 seconds on each channel, and you're not getting any depth. Now, we have a writing lab at West Valley Community College, and last year we were using a software by Pearson Communications. My apologies if any of you work for them. It was called My Comp Lab, and it was difficult to work with as a visually impaired person. For one thing, they mislabeled the alt tags, so it was really hard to find you. We were on the screen, but it was also just really tough in other respects because there were these files, and it would say. Writing activity or media activity, and it would say set A. Well, that was fine, but then it would say to do, and if you clicked on to do, it would take you to a different assignment and you didn't finish set A. And students would look at that word do and go, well, it said do, or it said proof, or it said finish. And they would click before they'd read the entire page and then be understandably amazed that, you know, the assignment wasn't completed. And I think that one of the problems, or let me say cautions instead of problems, one of the cautions that we have to contend with a scanning-based culture where eyes can look across a screen, grab a graphic, click on it, and have things happen, and take in multiple things at once, although that gives you a delicious overview, it causes you not to go deeper, not to read all the way through, not to pay connotational attention to language or to graphics or to whatever it is you're working on, and I contend that it also causes us not to listen. One of the changes that the researchers who I mentioned earlier and that I can collaborate myself, and I'd like to know what you think, notice is that with the increasing ability to access information rapidly, those who process mainly by eyesight are experiencing diminishing listening skills. They're growing up with graphical interfaces, but the idea of a narrator bringing something to life and the resonance of a character is not there because the spoken word experience is not there anymore. Now the flip side of that is that those who are blind and visually impaired, who experience only the voice, only the speech technology, are not coming into haptic, sensual, tactile content with the language and are not understanding that the comma is alive, or that the semicolon breathes, or that the dash was Emily Dickinson's way of nodding at us to say, yeah, I am nuts, but don't tell. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And that may seem really esoteric, but whereas our students who experience much of their learning through their eyes need to be taught to listen more deeply, I contend that those of us who read and who may come of age without any braille are now going to need to be taught to read more slowly. One of the advantages of serial reading, which is what we do in braille, moving across a line of text, is that we slow down and we give our biology time to process what we're reading. And it's so very, very important. And the word rain, once you've had it cross your index fingers, will never be the same. And I think it's really important when we encounter parents who have ambivalence about their braille reading children. I think it's really important that we have these discussions and that we talk about why this is so very, very important to our kids. And the article on braille literacy that I'll share if we have time, she goes into that in detail. I hope I'm not being a cliche and preaching to what you already believe, but I think that having the ability to explain all this to other educators and to the parents of our students will make a difference in the kind of learning that we can impart. The last two little pieces that I'm doing on time.
You are, it's 2:52.
And what do we have till only three?
Okay. I'll try to do this really quickly, and then I've got to share something humorous with you. The other two things I wanted to say real quickly are the value and the difficulty of the internet. I think we all agree that we can get information more easily than we could, right? I mean, that's not the problem. But what do you do when somebody is writing a paper and she or he goes and basically block cuts and paste an entire article into a research paper and says, yeah, it's mine, I found it. Okay, we need to introduce the text, that means incorporate, cite, and document, but there's a sense of moving language around without language, without analyzing it, without pie, without point, information, explanation of significance for information. It's so, so, so important to know, okay, I can't just plop three paragraphs from Lewis Thomas' Lives of a Cell in here. I need to introduce him to my reader in my own writing and in my own voice and explain who he is. And this was, after all, my paper, and I need to credit that. And those are things that are difficult. And citing websites is like, you know, when you stand on the shore of the ocean and the sand goes out from under your feet with the tide, you know, it's always an archival thing. You've got to keep up with it all the time. That leads to my last point, and Steve Dresser gets credit for this one. We were having a conversation yesterday, and he said, well, you know, one of the things that worries me is we have more technologies than ever that allow us to capture information, but we render them obsolete almost as soon as we create them. So gone are LPs, right?
Nope, I still got mine.
Good for you, good for you. And you've got something to play on, I hope.
Yep.
That was his point, too. You know, if you eliminate the cassettes and the players and the reel-to-reel and the player, what do you do if you have this archive, which is your literacy, and no way of accessing it? We need to be mindful of this and to take good care of all these items as well. I now want to do something humorous, if I might, because I think you'll really like this. There we are. Steve Spiker gave me this file, and it's the kinds of spellings that result when people don't read. Appreciated, APRISIATED. Bear in mind, BARE. Caricature or character, I'm not sure what the person meant, CARICTER. Get some cheap speakers, CHEEP.
Cheap, cheap. From the birds.
Yeah. Add some new components, as in ANTS, ants. Okay? We speak this way, though, components. I'm not pronouncing that the way I should. Concerns, CONSERNS. Let's see. Cursor, CURSER. Let's see.
There is such a thing.
Right, I know there is. It's crazy. Floppies, FLOPPYS. Fluctuate, FLUCKSHUATE. Some are real speed freaks, EEKS. Okay. I'm not making fun of people, and I want to add that sometimes we have learning disabilities that cause us to reverse things, and this can happen to all of us, but I, as a teacher, have seen a proliferation of what I'm reading to you in the last 10 to 12 years, and I would imagine that you have as well. I liked this one. There's a problem, infect, there's a big one, INFECT. Okay. But at this point, I'd like to conflate what I was going to do with the, that's a real word. It's putting together two activities that you weren't necessarily going to bring together. I want to combine the technology autobiography activity with your responses, and I'd like to open the discussion up to have you talk about what you're experiencing in your classrooms and how it's affecting what you do and how you teach and what steps you are taking to work with the changes and to remain in control of what's going on there. So I'd like to invite some comment about that, if I might. Right.
I've gone back to some old ways of doing things. I had in the past several years, I had sort of tried to become really modern and allow people to create rough drafts on the computer and things like that, and had stopped using note cards for research papers and stuff like that. This past year, I changed my approach and went back to using note cards and research papers and rough drafts, either done on the Braille ride or with my print users. Mm-hmm. With Mm-hmm. And I just find that it did a couple of things. It made people have to really think about what they were moving from the rough draft page to the computer or to the braille mode.
Yeah.
And it also made them have to work harder at organization, which they really lacked when we went straight to the computer. Even though when I first went to the computer with everything, I was like, isn't this great? When I was in college, I had to do all this complex process. Now, you can go in and proofread. Well, you're right. People don't know how to proofread very well, and they're trying to kind of skip that process, but taking it back to sort of its basics again, I think really gave my students a lot more depth. The other thing that I found that now in vocabulary, I have to teach the whole homonym thing every year. Once upon a time, people got that in elementary and middle schools, and we didn't have to deal with it in high school.
Yeah.
I have to deal with it every year. As a matter of fact, I have a whole vocabulary section that I do every single year in high school just to try to drill it in, because kids continuously make mistakes on that all the time because spell check doesn't catch it.
Sounds like you're in really good control of what's going on there. That's really neat.
Just a couple. I have some others, but I'll let somebody else
know. Okay. Good.
I'm finding that even in college, there are people who will compute nothing about calculus.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
There's nothing they'll compute about. The simplest thing, they have to grab their calculator. What do I do about it? And at this level, I don't. If it were a younger group, I'm sure I would do drill and practice, but if they're in college, they're not going to change that, probably. On the teaching side, though, I've changed the way I teach. I don't use PowerPoints.
You do or don't?
I do.
You do, okay. Okay, good.
And I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they can look at them later, and I put them up on Blackboard.
Right.
As a foreign language teacher, I've had a lot of interesting experiences, and even with ESL students, we could have a whole conference on that.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the examples of things that I've seen in my classroom, just a few weeks ago, I was correcting a French final, about a month ago, I guess it was, and somebody wrote, "You are," just the word "you are," and my reader was reading "you are," I didn't know what it was. She didn't know what it was. And I marked it wrong, of course. And it was for, they were translating some verb phrases into English, and it was vous êtes, you are. And I marked it wrong, even after I knew what it was. And my students, my student, he was indignant. He was like, "Well, Miss Hayes, it's you are, can't you see that?" I said, "No, it's not. Vous êtes means Y-O-U space A-R-E, not er. It's wrong." And he was so mad about that. And the other thing I see, as a language teacher, at the end of the 9 weeks or at the end of the year, one of their finals is they have to make a speech entirely in the target language, and they have to write the speech, put it together, where they're describing their family and all that. And I see people, they'll get these electronic translators, and they'll take one word and they'll say, string sentences together, and you've got unconjugated verbs, and you've got all of these things happening, and I can sniff out botched electronic translation faster than a dog can sniff out a piece of meat. And then they'll go on the internet and they'll come up with sentences and things with words that we haven't had. So finally, I just banned the internet from my classroom for these types of projects. I told them the only computer that you are allowed to use is the computer between your 2 years that the good Lord gave you. And the resources are your notes and the dictionaries that we've used, and I've shown you how to use. And you're not allowed to do anything you don't know how to do. It's just that simple. Now, if we're doing a research cultural thing and they have to find out about the Reign of Terror in France or the political structure, what happened in Cuba, after the post, just things like that. Okay, that's research. Okay, you can use web as one of your sources, but I've got to see what that source is. And if there's plagiarism, you're in trouble. So I guess those are a few examples of some of the things I'm going through and how to handle them.
One other thing I'd like to say is my students have a hard time. I do a long session on understanding valid sources, but they have a really hard time getting that whole community thing.
Yeah.
And I think it has to do with the, I love the fact that we can go to the internet and get sources for research papers that we never could get in our libraries before. I love that we can go to magazines and to journal articles and stuff like that. But I think it's related to that whole thing about talking to people that you think you know on the internet, but you really don't.
Yeah.
And it's true in English class, too. I had a student who wrote a paper on, I also teach a semester of psychology, and she got this source about bipolar disorder, which was ridiculous. I mean, somebody just made it up, I guess. It had nothing to do with bipolar disorder. But somebody's created imaginary bipolar. And it took me forever to make her understand that that was not a legitimate source.
I think that Wikipedia is a good source, right?
Yeah. Well, not just Wikipedia. Anything. And I make them go on virtual library now, for anything, because if you don't, they just pull something out of the air all the time.
Yeah.
And say, oh, I got the source off, it's great.
Yeah.
The one thing, I know I'm a teacher of elementary children that are learning disabled students, and what a lot of the technology, they want things done instantaneously. They don't want to put any effort into doing something. If you're reading a two-page story, you should be able to read it in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, we were talking about math. We don't let them use calculators in our school until they get out of fifth grade. And they'll do their homework on there instead of having remainder in division. It goes out.
To show that.
That's when you ask them, what does this mean? They have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
They're just done on that. So, in ways, it is good because it does. They can use the computer to read material that they are not capable of reading, but then they don't always have some stuff that they
use. Well, I'm glad they're using the calculator at a young age because, in some ways they've got to know it.
Well, yeah, we do teach them to use it, but we don't.
I mean, I'm glad that they're not using the calculator.
Right, we teach them, but we don't let them use that all the time because you've got to know the basics before you just have that machine do it for you.
Right. Susan, this is Diane from Colorado.
Yes.
I'm primarily, of course, with a kindergarten student.
Mm-hmm.
So, I noticed when you were, mentioning the spellings of some of those words, of course you spelled it correctly, and it made me think, because when one of my niece was in school, she's now in her 20s and, got this college stuff, she went through the whole language and, that process, which, and phonetic spelling.
Yes.
How many of those students may have had that? I know when I was in college, late high school, early college, back in the 70s, this speak with my age, sorry. But I went through that modern math situation, and that really messed me up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had to literally relearn that, relearn math after that modern math, because it just really messed me up.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I want to say in my school with our teachers, when they go through, talk about the writing, with the students, the kindergarten teacher, will mention, okay, comma, okay, needs a little pause, or a period needs a little stop, the question mark, question, of course, and then you have the quotation, that means someone is talking, so we try to relate some of these. But I've worked with second graders, later on in their reading,
mm-hmm.
and they still did not know what some of these functions were.
Yeah.
And it just,
And I think it's also, you know, good to know that it's a natural part of our growth as thinkers to make errors. Minor Shaughnessy says that an error is an expectation. And so there's a way in which when something happens, you can say, oh, that's cool, I'm glad you tried that comma. Now, actually, in this sentence, you don't need it, but let's talk about where you do. Or, that's an interesting spelling, I know why you did that. You know, because I think it's really important that people, we're going to have to error as we try. And I think that's a super, super important part of what we do.
Yes.
I have one other thing to say. We have smart boards at our school, and I noticed that our teachers are encouraged to use them to give tests. Of course, they give multiple choice tests, so all the tests they're giving are multiple choice. So they're, and then our writing scores are not what they should be, but they don't get, you know, you teach writing, but then you don't apply it across the curriculum. So I think that's a problem. The whole class can sit up and take a test, which is the A, B, C, or D, and you grade it as they're going.
Right.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, this is Diane again. I know when I was reading with my second graders, you know, we would come across one, you know, a punctuation mark that they did have trouble with. And I would go back and, okay, well, let's read this again. And, you know, so that it sounds correctly. And I had them read it the way they did the first time. And then we had it read it correctly. And I said, no, which sounds better? Mm-hmm. You know, so that they could see the difference. That the first time they read it was incorrect.
I have a proposal to make here. Are there any more comments? I don't want to shut anybody down. This is great.
I just want to say one other little thing about Braille. I think that, and I love all of the ways that we can access material nowadays. And I know that at my school, we're really conscientious about making sure that everyone who is capable of learning Braille learns it and uses it throughout the curriculum all day, every day. But I really worry in places where, especially the teachers don't understand that in order to be a good Braille reader, you must read it all the time. I worry about schools, and I know this because we get students in sometimes in middle or high school who primarily access that through listening. And I really think that it's incumbent upon all of us to emphasize wherever we can and afford it. You know, we'll have parents who whine and grow is difficult and oh, it's hard. And it's very easy once you learn it and you're using it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think we fight that battle so much, but, you know, we're in a controlled environment where we can absolutely make sure that everybody reads Braille who is capable of reading Braille.
Yeah.
I mean, not that we don't use other technologies for children who have more complex issues, but we do. But I just think we all, as teachers, have to emphasize the importance of using Braille all the time.
Yeah. Then I definitely want you to have this Sarah Blake article. And if people want, I can read it here. I have a proposal, and I'm hearing some wonderful ideas about what's happening and what we do, how we each cope with it, handle it. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here. You know, NABT has a newsletter, and I think it would be really neat to have a best practices column where we write in and we continue this conversation, and we say, this happened in my classroom today. This is what I did. What are you doing about this? I think this is a discussion. Best practices are how we all stay fresh, right, and alive, and it's really important. And I'm wondering if there's a way that we can either work through our newsletter to implement that, although it only comes out a couple times, or if there's even a way, okay, I'm going to say the scary word, we can do this on the web, you know, creating a discussion group or something, because I think it's pretty valuable stuff.
Well, would you want to streamline the first issue of the column, calling it best practices?
Sure.
Getting it started.
I could get it started, and then, but I've heard so many wonderful ideas in here. It's clear that everybody in here has something to contribute to this column. And I just think it's really important. I just want to wind up by saying that anyone else who wants to finish out can. I value the tools. You know, I got a Braille sense this year, and I discovered something, which is that when my students give me their papers as Word document files on a stick drive, on a thumb drive, I am able to be a much better editor. So now they come into the office with their hard copy draft, and I have my draft, and they have pen in hand. We go through it together, and we're both doing a better job of close reading. And I'm just so grateful to have that Braille access to the people I work with, and I acknowledge that it comes to me through a paperless Braille, you know, computer. So I don't think we want to throw away our tools. I think what we want to do is shape them and make sure that we, as learners, control how technology is used, not the inventors of the technology or not the faddish nature of the technology, I guess.
One thing that I'd like to add to the discussion, I mean, especially for the post-secondary side of things, in being more, I guess, grounded in the technology, I find myself, especially in one of my jobs, I work with a lot of graduate students who are online all the time. And so communication for them is beyond rapid.
Yeah.
And I find myself firing off emails at, you know, two or three per minute. And what I've gone back and done is implemented a feature in my email program that forces it to spell check. And in my signature, it always picks up my last name as a spelling error. So even if I have the instinct to hit send, I can stop it,
yes,
go back, and reread it just to make sure that what I'm sending is really what I want to be sending.
Yeah, exactly.
So the technology, while it can certainly hinder literacy, we can find ways to ensure that it allows us to have that deeper reading.
I agree with you entirely.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the nose. It's what we do with it. And part of what we want to teach our students is, how do you get the depth out of this? How do you do this? You know, the danger of a culture where decisions can be made within quarter or nanoseconds is the loss of reflection time. And I'm sure glad that a lot of the earliest wars, well, I just don't like to think about, well, you know where I'm going with that, you know. I think that our biology, if nothing else, can't cope with nanosecond thinking. We need time to process. Yes, yes, I do. I'll give it to everyone right now. It is, I'll give you my home email, although I do have one at the college too, but home email is great for this. It is SUSANSCHULTER, and that's all run together, no underline or anything, @att.net. Again, it's SUSANSCHULTER@att.net. I would also like to give you my cell phone number, because I like to get to know my friends and my colleagues through their voices. And I want you to feel comfortable calling me for any reason. 408-429-9567. My preference would be able to walk down the hall, meet you, and go for a cup of coffee. Since I can't, talk to me, please.
Well, I think you did a very good job. Let's give her a